The arbitration deadline was yesterday, and Vlad Guerrero is getting paid. Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Friday, January 10th. Your source of news, notes, and updates on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. You can follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. He's Troy Brock. Troy B. Baseball won the Twitter machine. And Troy, I want to get to the first power rankings of 2025 because MLB.com put those out. And we've got some really interesting names that you and I feel like might be too high or too low on some of these teams based on what they did in the offseason and where we think their 2025 is going to go. But first, the arbitration deadline came and went yesterday. This is the deadline. If you have not yet, if you as an MLB team have not yet reached a contract for 2025 with an arbitration eligible player, like this is the deadline to do that before you are set for an arbitration hearing. Now, almost every team in baseball is now at the point where they practice what's called trial and file. If we don't get a deal done by this deadline, we stop negotiating and we go to the arbitration hearing. And almost every team made a clean sweep of their arbitration guys, right? The Astros, every single one of theirs. The Blue Jays, every single one of theirs. The Reds, every single one of theirs. A lot of teams knocked out every single one. And there are some notable guys who got big deals. And then there's a couple notable players who didn't agree and are going to go to a hearing. So Vlad Guerrero Jr. of the Toronto Blue Jays, $28.5 million deal for 2025. It is the third highest salary to an arbitration eligible player in league history. The only ones that were larger were Juan Soto in 2024. He got $31 million. And Shohei Ohtani in 2023, he got $30 million. And then those two guys have signed the two largest contracts in MLB history. Does that mean that Vlad Guerrero Jr. is set to sign the third largest contract in baseball history after this final season in Toronto?
The correlation is certainly there since he's got the third largest pre-arbitration figure there, but I don't think he's going to get the third largest contract in the history of the sport just because of he's great. He's a great hitter when he is on, but you have to have the qualifier when he is on for in order for that him being a great hitter. And I'm a big Vlad Guerrero Jr. guy, but he's just not on consistently enough throughout his career to where he's going to be the third highest paid player in the history of the sport, in my opinion.
Yeah. Last year, it's important to note they went to arbitration and his number was $19.9 million. The team's number was $18.05. Guerrero won that arbitration hearing last year. So he was getting $19.9 million. And some people will read into the tea leaves that when you can agree to a contract without having to go to a hearing, it bodes well for a team trying to negotiate an extension for a team. I don't really think there's much to that. I think this is something they'll still continue to negotiate. Reportedly, we've heard, I think we talked about this, you and I did a week or two ago, that he's given them a number, and if they hit the number, he signs an extension. I kind of feel like at this point, this is probably the final season before he reaches free agency. And it's going to make things tough for them to figure out going forward. You know, can you get free agents to come if Vlad Guerrero ends up walking? What do you do with Bo Bichette? Do you try to trade Bichette at the deadline or before the season? What happens? Really going to be really interesting to see here. We saw some other notable guys. Tariq Skubal is getting a raise in his final year before free agency. Framber Valdez also getting a raise before his final year of free agency. Knowing that those two guys are at the top of the free agency market next year, and I haven't even looked at the rest of the class, but I believe Zach Gallen's in there as well. So that trio, I want you to decide, would you rather have this year's trio of Corbin Burnes, Blake Snell, and Max Fried, or next year's trio of Framber Valdez, Zach Gallen, and Tariq Skubal? Who would you rather take if you had to pick, I need a pitcher last offseason, or I guess this offseason, or next offseason?
Tariq Skubal does have one more year of arbitration eligibility.
Dang, that ruins the whole premise of my question. Go me. That was awesome.
But in answer to your question, if I still had to choose between those three pitchers, I would still probably choose Tariq Skubal just because of the improvements that he made while he was out with an injury from most of 2022 and then the first half of 2023. Ever since he came back in 2023, he's been a completely different pitcher. He changed up his delivery. He had more of a crossfire delivery before he went down with an injury, and he's kind of straightened out a lot since coming back, and while he was down he worked on straightening that out, and that's helped him out a lot. So out of those three pitchers, I think Tariq Skubal is the clear choice going forward, especially considering the age of Framber Valdez. He's older than both of those, Zach Allen and Tariq Skubal, but I would still probably take Framber Valdez over Zach Gallen, just because Zach Gallen has really kind of been inconsistent. He's had one great season or one great part of a season, and he's been good. He hasn't been bad, but he just hasn't been.
Not at the same level that a Corbin Burns was, that even a Blake Snell was.
Yeah, and he's going to do very well in that number two pitcher role. He's going to be one of the best number two pitchers in the sport, but he's just not at that ace level right now.
Absolutely going to be wild. I do find it interesting. Look at the Padres. They're a team I kind of want to look at on this. They exchanged salary figures and reached deals with four of these five big names. Luis Arraez, one of your favorite players in baseball, $14 million for 2025. Kind of a singles merchant, doesn't really do much else there. Dylan Cease, $13.75 million. They reached a deal with him without going to arbitration. Jason Adam, the reliever, $4.8 million. Luis Campusano, the catcher, $1 million. But righty Michael King, who really had a breakout after coming over to the club in the Juan Soto deal, did not reach an agreement, and they are going to arbitration. So this is a guy went 13-9 with a 2.95 ERA in 30 starts next year, or 30 starts last year. Sorry. It's the third consecutive year he's had an ERA under 3 in the majors, but it's the first time he did it from the rotation. Is this something where can San Diego really afford to nickel and dime a guy that looks as good as this and you still have under control for a few more years? Or is this something where they should have just said yes and signed him to a deal and hopefully even an extension to lock him in while he's cheap, given the fact that Dylan Cease could be on the move?
Yeah, this is somebody that that they probably needed to lock up, especially since they are kind of shopping Dylan Cease and everybody's trying to pull Dylan Cease away from him. I don't understand how Dylan Cease is being paid less than Luis Arraez, but that's a different story for a different day. But Michael King, I definitely think they should have just, especially since his spot rack has his projected arbitration figure at $10.7 million for what he did in 2024. That's chump change for what he did in 2024.
That's a deal. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a very team friendly deal. So I'm not sure how far off they are, but they probably can't be too far off, and they probably should have just pulled the trigger on it.
Yeah, and a quick reminder here, when you see that teams and players are both filing arbitration figures and the difference doesn't look that big, and Alex Vezia of the Dodgers is a great example of this. He filed at $2.35 million. The Dodgers filed at $2.05 million. And a lot of people are going to say the difference is $300,000. Just pay it. It's important to remember that when they were negotiating with each other, the Dodgers probably never got as high as $2.05 million. Vezia probably never got as low as $2.35 million. You're incentivized to come meet a little bit closer to the middle when you file your arbitration figures, simply because the arbitrator, the neutral arbitrator, does not have the ability to create a number. They have to take your number or the team's number. So this happened 1 year. I want to say it was 2 years ago with Max Fried, where he and the team were just a couple hundred thousand apart on like a $6 million deal. And people were like, why are you going to arbitration over $100,000? Because they were probably a lot farther apart when they were negotiating and they just happened to file at these numbers. So always definitely an interesting situation there. We don't have full numbers for everybody yet. Like, for instance, Kyle Tucker, we don't know what Kyle Tucker's number is going to come in with if, with the Cubs, if they signed him or if they're going to arbitration. But a couple other notable people, William Contreras of the Brewers did not agree to terms. He'll exchange figures, had a great year last year behind the plate. The Cardinals had a trio of guys not agree. Lars Nootbaar, Brendan Donovan, and Andre Pallante. We saw the Angels had like Luis Rengifo, Jose Quijada, and Mickey Moniak. Big difference in those names there. But for the most part, this kind of feels a little more anticlimactic than it used to in the past, because so many players now agree to terms, or even in some cases, sign extensions like Brent Rooker of the A's, who would have been in arbitration and instead signed a multi-year deal. Is this kind of because the way that so many clubs work now, where they'll just go to the trial after giving, like filing trial, and they won't actually negotiate? Do you think is that kind of suppressing salaries a little bit, or is this just, it just happens to work out maybe coincidentally that less guys are going to trials than in the past?
I think a little of both can be true. I think that teams have a set figure before they reach the arbitration deadline where they're like, we're going to get as high as this figure. And if we don't come to an agreement, then we're going to arbitration. That's just all there's going to be about it. And if you are cool with whatever figure we give you, then so be it. We won't go to arbitration. Plus, a lot of players, I mean, it's hard to go to arbitration because your team, we heard Corbin Burns talk about this when he was still with the Brewers, your team goes in there and they talk down about you and they try to talk bad about you to make the arbitrator side with them and take their figure over your figure. And you have to go prove your case as to why you deserve the money that you deserve. And it kind of, in some cases, it ruins relationships like it did with Corbin Burns and the Brewers. And so it's just, it's not a fun process. And I think that has a little bit to do with it as well, but it, as well as the file and trial, like you said.
Yeah, it's a really weird situation here. And arbitration's always felt a little odd to me, where it's, in essence, the team's in their best interest to make you look bad in front of the arbitrator, and then you have to come back and play for them the next season, and it's not awkward at all. It's kind of strange. Before we get into the power rankings real quick, saw a report that the Cardinals' chances of trading Nolan Arenado are considered to have dropped significantly. Obviously, winter meetings, they talked about they wanted to do it. They had a deal with the Astros. Nolan Arenado used his no-trade clause to block that. The Astros obviously went on to get Christian Walker and Isak Paredes, kind of shut that whole thing down. The Yankees had some conversations in early December. Apparently, they didn't like the contract demands there. And there were some reports now that the Boston Red Sox are working on a deal. I think this was MassLive.com reported about this. But if it doesn't go through, likelihood is that Arenado's probably staying in St. Louis. Is this a mistake on the Cardinals' part to not find a way to get him to one of the teams that he wants to go to? Or is this more of it's on Arenado for blocking a deal to the ballpark that would have done the best for his offensive numbers had he gone to Houston?
Yeah, I think honestly, I think it's a little bit of both again. I hate to cop out with that, but I think it's a little bit of both again, because I think Arenado should have agreed to the trade. I don't know what his reasoning was. I haven't seen it. I don't know if you've seen it or if it's even come out what his reasoning was for why he blocked that trade. But
I think he said something about being, I think the excuse was like being moved so early in the offseason. He wanted to wait for the offseason to develop some more. But that seems to be a weird excuse to me, because a lot of player movement had already been going on with Juan Soto and things like that done at that point. So that's kind of odd to me.
Right. And plus, it's not like his contract's going to change any. He's being traded. He's not signing in free agency or anything. So that doesn't make any sense. So I think he should have agreed to that trade for one. And just for two, I feel like it's kind of a Philly situation with Alec Bohm. The Phillies were kind of looking for way too much when they were shopping Alec Bohm earlier in the offseason. And we've seen in this offseason that trades of major league players are the returns are not anywhere near what they normally would be. And not that Alec Bohm should return any of the Seattle Mariners aces, but Nolan Arenado, even with his big contract, it would get a larger return than Alec Bohm would. And the Cardinals are probably looking for what that return normally should be. And it's just not what they're going to get this offseason. We've seen it time and time again with all of the trades.
Yeah, like the biggest trade this offseason is Kyle Tucker. And he went for a top 100 prospect in Cam Smith. I think it's pretty – it's yeah, I think he was like 73rd on MLB Pipeline when he got moved. And then infielder Isak Paredes, who is a flawed player but is very, very good at one specific thing, which is pulling balls in the air to left field. And then right-hand pitcher Hayden Wineski, who doesn't really move the needle either way for me. And that's Kyle Tucker, one who's going to be the top free agent available next offseason. By contrast, it's 3 years of Nolan Arenado, a declining player with also having significant ballpark issues. He's another heavy fly ball down the left field line kind of guy. So, yeah, this kind of feels like the Cardinals needed to just whatever we can get, right? I remember it's been about a year now, but when the Red Sox traded Chris Sale to Atlanta, they paid Sale's salary for the first season just to get him off the books, right? Atlanta had the salary for the next year, but they were willing to pay virtually all of the salary in year one just to get him off the books. And it feels like the Cardinals really needed to kind of be willing to come out of pocket in 25 to cover some of that salary, knowing that the Rockies are still covering $10 million of the $78 remaining, and that would not have gone away with the trade. The money would have gone from the Rockies to the new team. So just kind of a, I think, weird move all around. I don't think Nolan Arenado quite understood his market. I don't quite think the Cardinals were aggressive enough at being willing to just get him off the roster no matter what it took. The Red Sox would be interesting because then you have a situation of they now have to make a trade after that. If it goes through, Rafi Devers would move from third to first. You have Masataka Yoshida DHing, Tristan Casas at first base. Somebody would have to get moved out of that group. So curious to see what happens there. All right, I want to get to these power rankings with you real quick. MLB.com put out their first power rankings of 2025. To no one's surprise, Los Angeles Dodgers are number one. But I kind of want to talk about a team that we each think is too low and a team we each think is maybe too high. And since I'm kind of springing that on you here quickly, I guess I'll go first. My team that I think is too low, it's the Washington Nationals. They're at 25 on this list, but they brought in major league caliber players. They brought in Nate Lowe, Josh Bell, that's first base and DH locked up. Michael Soroka's a reclamation project in the rotation. If that doesn't work out, we saw how good he did in the bullpen down the stretch. They just signed Amed Rosario, I think either today or on Thursday. And they've got all these young prospects that they've called up, like a Dylan Cruz, like a James Wood, some of these guys. And so I can easily see a situation where the Washington Nationals, who are 25th on this, there's only you know, five teams worse than them on the power rankings in baseball, end up in the middle of the pack. Like, if I told you they're going to have a better year than the Blue Jays, would you be shocked? If I told you they're going to have a better year than the Pirates, would you be shocked? And I think that's kind of where I am with Washington, is they have, it's very easy to see them overachieving past this 25th ranking if some of these young players just hit the ground running, combined with the veterans they added hit.
Yeah, 100% agree. I'm very high on the Washington Nationals entering 2025 with that young core that they built. Dylan Cruz is going to finally have a full season of Major League Baseball this year. Yep. And he, while he struggled in his short time in the majors in 2024, he did show flashes of that greatness that everyone expects from him at times. And with more consistent playing time at the Major League level, he should be even better, as well as James Wood. You and I kind of talked.
Time out. Sorry to interrupt. I just saw the tweet while we were recording this on Thursday night, everybody. The Cubs and Kyle Tucker officially do not have a deal. The Cubs have filed at $15 million. Kyle Tucker has filed at $17.5 million. For a pending free agent, how do you not sign Kyle Tucker to the deal that he is asking for, knowing that you're going to be trying to re-sign him after one season? What the heck are the Cubs doing here?
I don't get it. I think Kyle Tucker's arbitration figure is too low. I think he's I know he came down on it from what he wanted before having to submit an arbitration figure, but damn, I think he's closer to it, to especially in a third year of arbitration, he's closer to like a $24-25 million guy, especially if like Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is getting 28.5. Kyle Tucker's on that same level, if not better than Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And so
I do think part of it is because it's always based on your previous performance. And I want to say, didn't he have like, he was making like, I think 2023, he made $5 million. Last year, I think he was projected to make like 12.6 or something, but it's just, like, he's been underpaid. It's hard to get a significant jump up into the 20s like Vlad is. But still, this is absolutely not a, like, what are you doing here? Give the man his money so you have a chance to re-sign him. What are we doing?
In the words of John Malkovich, pay that man his money. I don't get it, man. That don't make any sense. In my opinion, it's a lot less likely the Cubs extend him now than it was before, even though Kyle Tucker said publicly he's willing to an extension. I don't believe that then, and I believe that even less now going forward.
Yeah, what a dumb move. Okay, I'm sorry. You were talking about power rankings. Let's go back to that. Sorry.
Yeah, no. I was agreeing with you that the Nationals are too low. Dylan Cruz is going to take a step forward in 2025 with more major league time. James Wood should have a better 2025. He had a good 2024, and he should have a better 2025. You and I talked about that on Twitter, I think Wednesday. And so, I agree with you completely that the Washington, I think they're going to be an above 500 team. I don't think they're going to have another season consecutively below 500. I think they're going to crack that mark, and then 2026, they might be in a wild card spot, not just contending for one.
They were, for context, they were 71-91 last year. So you're looking at a 10 game improvement needed to get to 500. Not going to call it a hot take, but I'll call it a pretty warm take there from Troy Rock. All right, who do you think is too? Let's stick with low. Who do you think is too low on this power ranking?
I'm going to stick with the National League East for who I think is too low. And I'm going to say the Philadelphia. No, I'm just kidding. They're second. I'm going to say the.
they're second on this list. Are they better than the Dodgers somehow? Okay, yeah.
Well, they beat the Dodgers more than the Dodgers beat them in the regular season in 2024. The Atlanta Braves are too low. Okay. And they're fifth on this
list. They're fifth. Yeah, they're in fifth place. But notably, ahead of them, the New York Mets at four. And the Phillies at two. So they're third in the division on the power rankings.
Which I think is completely backwards. I think it's just jumbled because I think that the Atlanta Braves are going to win the division in 2025 with a healthy Ronald Acuna Jr., a healthy Spencer Strider. Matt Olson's not going to have the worst season of his career. Marcell Ozuna improved from 23 to 2024. I don't think he's going to improve again, but I think that he will be as good as he was in 2023. Austin Riley was hurt for most of 2024. Michael Harris the second was hurt for most of 2024. Mm-hmm. Sean Murphy had his worst season when he wasn't in his career when he wasn't hurt. So the Braves were historically injured in 2024, and they still finished with 89 wins.
They still made the postseason.
And still made the postseason. People are sleeping on the Braves hard. I think that the Braves are going to win the National League East. I think the Phillies are going to come in second in the National League East, and I think the Mets are going to be battling off the Nationals for third in the National League East.
Sounds like you're saying the Mets are too high than at four.
Oh, God, yeah. That's not who I'm going to be answering my question with, but yes.
Yeah. Speaking of, if you want to hear more about kind of this division, on today's Braves Today podcast, I talked to Chris Towers of CBS Sports Fantasy, and we talked about this division and how these three teams all lined up. He's also high on the Nationals. I don't think quite as high as you, but he is high on the Nationals to get back into relevance. But we did talk about these three teams and how they all line up. So go ahead and see more of that. A team that's too high for me is the New York Yankees at three. And this is something they went up in the rankings despite losing Juan Soto. And yes, they added guys, right? They added Cody Bellinger. They added Paul Goldschmidt. That have really impressed me five seasons ago. I don't think it has the same level of impressiveness when you add those guys for 2025. Goldschmidt did look better down the stretch last year. Yeah. Bellinger had a really good 2023 in a contract year. But I love the pitching additions. I love the addition of Max Fried. I do think that deal's too long. I like the addition of Devin Williams. If they wanted to re-sign him, that'd be great. But you're banking on a lot of resurgence from Paul Goldschmidt and Cody Bellinger, and both of these guys are short-term fixes. And I still don't know if your holes at second or third base, depending on where you play Jazz, you're banking on Jason Dominguez becoming at least major league average guy almost right away. And we know young players can do it. We saw Jackson Churio struggle in the first half and then go nuclear down the stretch. But it just feels like there's a lot of questions here to call this the third best team in baseball. I think if you'd said they were seventh, sixth, even, I'd have been like, okay, they got Aaron Judge. They added some good defense. You could get some resurgent offensive stuff out of these guys, but third's just too high for me for the Yankees.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think a lot of this is just recency bias because mm-hmm. they made the World Series, and it's the American League. I've said it multiple times. The American League was the much weaker side of the bracket in 2024, yep. and it's going to continue to be as such because all of the stars are going to the National League. All of the big-name players are going to the National League. The biggest-name player that's not in the National League right now is Aaron Judge, and he's a Yankee, and he's also getting it late into his 30s. So like you said, the Yankees are currently banking on a senior citizens home to push their way into the postseason in the World Series.
Yeah. All right. So who do you have as too high on this list?
Gonna stick in the American League, but not the East. I'm gonna go to the American League Central, and I'm gonna go with the Detroit Tigers at 11.
Ooh, okay. Let's hear this. Is it the rotation?
The rotation, the offense is still not great. They had one of the worst offenses in baseball in 2024, even in their hot stretch. They were worse in the second half of the season, which contained their hot stretch, than they were in the first half of the season. Granted, it was by .002 per team OPS, but it's still worse. And yeah. So their offense is not good. It was in the bottom third of baseball in both of those stretches. The rotation outside of Tarik Skubal is not great. I don't understand. I still don't understand the Alex Cobb signing and why that was a thing.
For $15 million bucks too. Like,
right.
Did you have who was banging down your door to like, who did you have to beat on the offer at $15 million bucks for Alex Cobb? You couldn't have done that for 10 or 12 or, you know, 9 and change.
Yeah,
15.
Yeah, and Gleyber Torres, another guy, $15 million bucks. He's probably going out. Well, they have Riley Green. He's going to be a top three hitter in their lineup, and he's not great. I mean, he's going to be better than the good news for them is they're not going to be starting Javier Baez every day. The bad news is they still have to field a team, and outside of Riley Green, they really don't have much on offense to be proud of. And outside of Tarik Skubal, they don't have much in the rotation that they can be proud of consistently.
I do think this is somewhere kind of like Washington, where a lot of the young players can really kind of turn this around, right? If Colt Keith, who's moving to first base this year out of deference to Gleyber, if Colt Keith can, the lesser defensive responsibilities can help him. If Josh Young can acclimate to the majors, like you can see a path where they could be a better offense. I still don't think it's enough though. To your point, they were still a bottom third offense in baseball. Doesn't feel like they're going to do enough. And I know a lot of people are probably yelling at their TV screens or their phones right now. Like, they made the rotation work with Skubal and a bunch of loose change down the stretch. There is a difference in doing that for 2 months and doing that for a full season. And even then, I would argue it didn't work in the postseason. Like, the bullpen games were not working the same in the postseason they did in the regular season. Cleveland's a good example of what happens to a team when you lean on your bullpen too hard in the regular season. They virtually doubled up everybody else in WAR from the bullpen. I think they had like 7.3 WAR from their bullpen. Only one other team, Atlanta, was within half of that figure. But Manuel Clase gave up as many runs in October as he did the entire regular season, because all of those guys had ridiculous workloads. I mean, they were like, if you go and you look at their most used relievers, Hunter Gaddis threw 74 and two thirds innings, Clase threw 74 innings, Cade Smith threw 75 innings. Like, they just rode these guys so hard that they fell apart down, like, in the postseason, the workload kind of reflected. And I think that's where the Tigers are, is I don't know if they just mentally don't think they have to do as much work because they can fall back on what worked last year, but that's not sustainable for an entire season. And I think that's one of the questions you're going to have for Detroit, is how do we make this work when you get to July and you've already used 8 or 9 starters and all but 2 of them have ERAs over four, right? That's kind of your issue here. I get that. Is there any team on here that's just perfect placement, exactly where they should be?
Maybe the Cubs at 13. I mean, you could probably make an argument that they're a little low. Actually, they are very low because the Brewers are ahead of them. I think the Cubs are much better than the Brewers. So we'll go Astros at 9.
Okay.
I like the Astros at 9.
See, the argument I was going to make for the Cubs at 13 is one of the things we talked about, is like every position on the field is an above average guy, but nobody is a top 5 player at their position except for Kyle Tucker. So putting them just a couple spots above the midpoint kind of feels like it makes sense.
Right. That's where I was going with that, until I saw that the Brewers were ahead of them, and the Brewers took a step back this offseason while the Cubs
losing Devin Williams. Forward. They added Nestor Cortes. What? You're not a believer in Nestor Cortes' ability to anchor rotation? Yeah. No, I get it. I will say the Dodgers at number 1. Yeah, no, 100% makes sense. That just completely tracks. And it's going to be really interesting to see. I think the big question, we haven't talked a ton about the Dodgers other than them signing everybody and being stacked. I do think it's really interesting to see what we get out of Shohei Ohtani. How is his season different in 2025 when he is pitching as well as hitting for the first time in a Dodgers uniform? Does he take it easy on the steals? Where does he kind of cut back to conserve energy? We'll talk about this more coming up on a future episode of the show. In the meantime, if you're listening on audio, do us a favor, leave us a 5-star review. If you're on YouTube, subscribe to the channel, hit the notification bell. We're working to get up to 500 subscribers by opening day, so we want to get that done. Until next time, this has been First Pitch.